And welcome, everybody, to Midday on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Happy Columbus Day and happy beginning of Fleet Week here in Charm City. Well, the pace of bizarre events in the presidential campaign continues at a dizzying speed. On Friday, David Fahrenthold of The Washington Post broke the story that in 2005, Donald Trump bragged about committing sexual assault to, of all people, George Bush's cousin. In the debate last night, Mr. Trump said it was just locker room banter and that the assaults never happened. Julian Assange of WikiLeaks released emails hacked from Clinton campaign manager John Podesta's Gmail account, which indicated that in some speeches to Wall Street banks, Secretary Clinton discussed the need to hold one position in private and another in public. Last night, she said that other political leaders who did so include Abraham Lincoln. This only confirmed for her detractors that she can't be trusted. Over the weekend, about 50 Republican lawmakers, according to NBC News, including Senator John McCain and Senator Rob Portman, disowned Trump. Trump disowned them right back and even publicly parted ways with his running mate over policy in Syria. Clinton is widely credited with not making any mistakes last night, but the Trump camp most certainly considers it a win for him. So let's put winning and losing aside for the moment and ask two political observers what we learned last night and where we've come in this sui generis campaign as it enters its final month. Liz Copeland is the founder of the Urban Conservative Project and former Republican candidate for the Baltimore City Council. Charles Robinson reports on business and politics for Maryland Public Television. We'd love to know what you thought about last night's debate. You can give us a call, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or drop us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. So Liz Copeland, let me start with you. There's a school of thought that says that Hillary Clinton does much better and actually gets a bump in the polls when she is presented to the voters unfiltered by the media, which is to say that after the convention, after the Benghazi hearings, her numbers went up. After the convention, her numbers went up. After the first presidential debate, her numbers went up. So last night, do you think, I mean, as a person who's not going to vote for Hillary Clinton, at least that's what you told us the last time you were here.
That's still true.
Yeah. Do you think that, you know, she presented herself in a good light to those voters in particular who were disinclined to vote for her in the first place?
No, I don't think that she nor Donald Trump presented themselves in a compelling way or in a light most favorable for those undecided. I think their sole goal was to firm up their base. Donald Trump certainly needed to firm up his base because he was getting a lot of heat, a lot of pushback from elected officials, from John McCain. Paul Ryan today just released a statement that he will not campaign with him, nor will he defend him. Trump's own wife couldn't defend his statement. So he needed to come out there and he needed to shore up his base. Maybe some undecideds would look at Hillary to give her a chance last night, but I don't think that she was able to present a compelling argument that undecideds should vote for her. And it's not that she doesn't have more policy experience. She doesn't have more articulable positions on a whole host of things when compared to Trump. I don't think she was given an opportunity last night, or she didn't seize the opportunity to speak directly to undecideds. They were fighting each other, a battle of words, a battle of critiques about personalities and character. And I don't think that she was able to put forth a statement that was any different than what anyone, especially from her camp, has ever said about Donald Trump.
Yeah, Charles Robinson, I mean, this notion of Trump stemming the bleeding, you know, I mean, they were hemorrhaging Friday night, Saturday. By Sunday night, you know, when the dust had settled, do you think he'd calm the fears of at least his base?
Let me start with this idea. This is now the most contentious, the most awkward presidential race we have ever had in history.
Awkward, certainly it is.
I mean, who knew we were going to be talking about? You know, when your staff called me and said, come on Monday, I was like, oh, we're going to have some policy issues.
Surprise.
Surprise. We didn't have that. Let me talk about your question about who each of these candidates had to talk to. Trump had to stop the hemorrhaging. You're absolutely right when we look at what he had to do. But if you listen to the language, each one was speaking to a specific portion of their base. In Trump's case, he had to reassure those Republicans who were going that 40, 42, 45%, depending on what poll you look at. They're going to vote for him anyway. That, yeah, you got to keep voting for me. No worries, okay? in Mrs. Clinton's case, her idea was, I just want to keep calm, because if I allow him to rattle me a little bit, that may come off as not a good thing in a political. But her language was about, you know, the others, as I call them, you know, and they're grouped in women, millennials, and minority voters. And she came off a little bit more personable. Trump was a little stiff, but I think if you listen, you realize this was a draw. This was not a winner or loser, but this was a draw. And if that's the case, then technically Trump did all right. He didn't win. He did all right. Notice I didn't say he won. He did all right. And he helped himself, because he can still go out and talk to the faithful. And the faithful are just that.
I think that's interesting that we talked about winners and losers. And people say it all the time. Talk show hosts ask all the pundits all the time, who won? And my question is always, well, what's the rubric? What are we grading them on? Did they, if ultimately they want to persuade undecideds to vote for them, if that's the sole goal of having these forums and these debates?
And the common wisdom says that it has to be the goal, because his faithful, that base of support for Trump, isn't enough to win the election.
But
it's enough
to
win the primaries, but not the election.
But in this case, Charles is right. There were faithfuls who may not have decided they were jumping ship and going to vote for Clinton, but they were going to stay home. It wasn't going to be enough for them. His presentation, his statements, he's made so many gaffes. He made so many offensive comments that in their opinion, it may not have been enough for them to go to the polls anymore. Last night, he needed to tell them, look, this is important. If Clinton wins, you will have more untrustworthiness. You'll have more pay to play. He mentioned Soros and Blumenthal, which the average voter probably has no idea. That's inside the Beltway talk. But he mentioned those people, but he didn't connect the dot. He didn't say, this is important because I understood the point he was trying to get to. And to your earlier statement about people saying Clinton is best in an unscripted situation, I think that Donald Trump...
Or at least unfettered by media interpretation. When it's just her doing the
fair talk. Point. I think actually that was his best setting. He looked strong. He walked around. He at some point you could see the difference between Donald Trump's stature and Hillary Clinton's. And while she may have been articulating a better point, she looked smaller. And at other times, he looked like he was looming over her, which I think is a negative, especially coming off of this this discussion about how he treats women and how he talks about women. I don't think that was a positive representation of his candidacy. But I think if you were to ask me who won the debate based on who did they convince to support them, I would say that Donald Trump won that debate. The first debate, he lost. Well, it was a draw because she didn't beat him as much as I thought that she should have. But last night, I don't think Hillary Clinton was able to articulate her point. She was fending off his statements. He kept interrupting her. And that one zinger, you know, we don't want Donald Trump with his temperament to be in control of our laws. His comeback, because you'd be in jail. I mean, that was a slam dunk, for especially for undecideds. That would have made them consider Donald Trump and the possibility that Clinton may not be the
but
person.
But that kind of aggressive behavior, it's interesting. When Tim Kaine was aggressive in the vice presidential debate against Mike Pence, Pence was credited with staying calm, staying, you know, exhibiting nothing but equanimity.
Trust me, that vice presidential debate didn't change anybody's mind.
Yeah, but now here's Trump being aggressive, and he's applauded for the same thing that they criticized Tim Kaine for. It's interesting.
One of the things that, as I'm watching last night's debate, and it was brought to my attention, this was probably the largest female audience watching a presidential debate, because there was a football game on last night. Now, their numbers were pretty low, but the large number of the female audience was there, and they were waiting because of what had transpired over the weekend.
But I wonder what they expected. I mean, even if Trump had said, I'm really sorry, I shouldn't have done it, would anybody believe that?
Well,
is it credible?
I think there is. And I'll go back to this believers group that Trump has. And actually, Hillary has the same, Ms. Clinton has the same group. But in the case of Donald Trump, I think what you have are these are a little bit older women. They're not millennials. You know, they keep talking about, well, you can't get the millennials. Well, guess what? Donald Trump maybe have maybe 2% of the millennials. He ain't getting most of them.
Clinton's not getting the millennials.
Well, I mean, I wanted to get to that, but let me talk about what this group that his that heard the women who heard this and kind of like, well, you know, let's see if he apologizes. Because if he can apologize, we can move on. Because that's what his campaign was. We want to move on.
Before you make your point, let's hear what he said about that.
Yes, I'm very embarrassed by it. I hate it. But it's locker room talk. And it's one of those things. I will knock the hell out of ISIS. We're going to defeat ISIS. ISIS happened a number of years ago in a vacuum that was left because of bad judgment. And I will tell you, I will take care of ISIS.
So, Mr.
And
Trump,
we should get onto much more important things and much bigger things.
Just for the record, though, are you saying that what you said on that bus 11 years ago, that you did not actually kiss women without consent or grope women without consent?
I have great respect for women. Nobody has more respect for women than I do.
So for the record, you're saying you never did that?
I said things that, frankly, you hear these things I said, and I was embarrassed by it, but I have tremendous respect for women.
Have you ever done those things?
Women have respect for me, and I will tell you, no, I have not.
So is that even approach an apology and contrition?
No.
That's called, let's move on. That's what it is. It's one of
those things, and I will knock the hell out of ISIS.
Right.
That's what he said. I mean, that's not even a pivot. It's a leap.
Right, but he didn't connect the dots. First of all, I think, and I've stated this before, that Donald Trump is a narcissist, and this is, and I don't have the DSM-5, and I'm not trained in mental health, but something's wrong with this guy. The first thing that he says is that I am embarrassed. He talks about him. You're embarrassed? Let's talk about how offensive and aggressive and sexual nature your statements were. Let's address that, and let's show some contrition, some authentic apologies. And SNL did a little parody on how
wow,
he couldn't say the word apology, and it's really true. This guy cannot be sorry. And as you know, depending on what the definition is, I may or may not be a millennial. I'm not quite sure. Sometimes I thought I was Generation X, but last time I checked, I'm still in the millennial category, and I'm a minority, and I'm a woman. And I want to talk about that. His statement about the vulgar language, the aggressive nature about the woman's anatomy, Nancy O'Donnell, that he was going to he just wanted to grab her there.
Nancy O'Dell, right.
Odell.
Yeah. I'm glad you didn't say that.
No, I'm not going to Anna Navarro this. I'm not going to do that on this. YPR. That, if I were to take that aside and accept that as banter talk, that there are millions of men talking about grabbing women inappropriately, and that is a joke that's accepted in the locker rooms of America. Okay, I don't believe that to be the case, but let's say we do. I really focused on the part where he was talking about how he doesn't really care about another person, and that, you know, he wants to kiss a woman. He's going to go right in that. And that, to me, tells me he has no self-control and that he doesn't care about anyone else, about his desire. His apology said the same thing. The first thing was about him.
Yeah.
And that's concerning to give somebody that much power, have access to nuclear codes.
It doesn't seem to attenuate his support among those people who are, quite convinced of his candidacy, though. His numbers don't go down.
The people who are kind of like at the margins are kind of like, I want to vote for him. He's got to give me a reason to vote for him. But this kind of sucked all the oxygen out of the room.
You think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
he was cheered. He was cheered, and Ryan was booed by Trump supporters at his rally Saturday afternoon.
But, I mean, think about what he did a half hour before this debate.
Well, that's a whole other circus. We'll talk about it. We got to take a quick break.
Okay.
But we will talk about that little circus that happened, the pre-debate circus. We got a bunch of folks on the phone. We will try to get to you guys as soon as possible. Take a little break. Charles Robinson is the political business reporter for Maryland Public Television. Liz Copeland is the founder of the Urban Conservative Project. More on the debates when we come back. You can call us 410-662-8780. Send me a tweet at @MiddayTomHall or an email midday@WIPR.org. Stick around. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Plenty of folks on the phone. If you'd like to join us, call 410-662-8780. Midday@WIPR.org is our email address, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Coming up a little later today, Aaron Dworkin is the dean of the School of Music, Theater, and Dance at the University of Michigan and the founder of the Sphinx Organization in Detroit, which works to connect people of color with jobs as classical musicians. And coming up tomorrow, DeRay McKesson and Ralph Moore will join me for a conversation about the Black Lives Matter movement and its lineage in the civil rights movement of the 1960s. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about the debate last night between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton with Liz Copeland, a former Republican candidate for Baltimore City Council, and Charles Robinson, a longtime political and business reporter for Maryland Public Television. So let's talk a little bit about who they were talking to. One of the things, Charles, that interested me is that Secretary Clinton tended to speak about Mr. Trump in the third person, and Mr. Trump spoke directly to Hillary. And I think his supporters were very happy about that, because he was addressing her directly. You know, you're going to be in jail, and you know, he looked at her and accused her of things. Secretary Clinton looked at the audience and spoke about him in the third person. What do you take?
First of all, from
that stylistic difference,
town halls. I've done a number of town halls, and I know you have too, Tom. Those are kind of tricky, because you don't want to get in the way as the moderator. You do want people to engage the candidates. This was what they had four people maybe ask? No, I think it was six.
Yeah, the so-called real voters seemed to be an afterthought.
Right,
yeah.
And every time they ask a question, it was the pivot from both of them. And like I said, I don't know if any minds were changed, but the way each of them approached this debate and the language they utilize, it's telling, because I think Trump was told by Rudy Giuliani, who's one of his advisors, and Chris Christie, you can't let her off. You can't let her off. And so that's why it became very personal. But I think the audience, at least I being part of that audience, was somewhat turned off by that. The personal wasn't working for me. I want to hear, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to make it work? And I think the moderators tried to focus them on that. And they went after both of them. They went after Hillary on the leaked emails about whether or not you're two-faced. Now, I'm going to tell you, in the hood, you tell somebody two-faced, you might get in a fight.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
But in this case, it was this question of the personal. And utilizing an Abraham Lincoln reference, you know, I was like, man, we're really going deep on this, you know.
And it's interesting to see if that criticism will stick, because obviously people do have private positions and public positions on all sorts of things. Mr. Trump himself prides himself on being unpredictable and not letting the enemy know what he's going to do and stuff like that. I mean,
well, that's different than taking a position publicly and then having a different position privately. And that was what most people took away from that email, that leaked email.
But saying both of those things and making yourself somewhat unknowable because of both of those things is a negotiating tool that all sorts of people use. I mean, this is something that happens in business, it happens in politics,
right.
It happens in the arts, I certainly know.
Right.
So it's just interesting that we'll see if that sticks. I mean, because we don't have the transcripts of the speeches. We just have emails from John Podesta to people in the Clinton campaign talking about these speeches.
But doesn't that underscore most Americans' perception about Hillary Clinton, that she cannot be trusted on face value?
Certainly.
That
and
she's
it's something
not
that she
authentic.
Needs to address.
Yes, yes.
And she certainly didn't put that kind
she
of
didn't put that the rest
to sleep
last night.
And the last part is this whole idea that Trump said, I'm going to have a special prosecutor look at you, and guess what? I'm going to lock you up.
Yeah.
And I'm going like...
Which is extraordinary.
I'm going like...
I was impressed by that, and I'm not oftentimes impressed by him.
No, that is almost a banana republic kind of comment.
Let's talk about that in a second. I want to go to the phone. Stuart from Baltimore is calling. Stuart, welcome to Midday. What's on your mind? Stuart has left the building along with Elvis. We're going to move to Lorenzo in Baltimore. Lorenzo, thanks for your call to Midday. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. First, I want to, you know, in full disclosure, I've been a Hillary, not just supporter, but fan. I've been totally impressed with her ever since she first hit the world stage, you know, some 30 years ago. I just think the world of her. One thing that has bothered me is this thing you guys are just talking about, or folks talk about how dishonest she is and how high her negatives are. I personally have not been able to find any kind of evidence or proof as to why that is, and I really truly believe it's only because that she's had millions and millions of dollars up against her for years trying to prove that fact. And just as a side note, the thing about the Abraham Lincoln reference, I heard this morning on MSNBC that they actually located that that's exactly what she was talking about. They provided so that when she made that comment, she was talking about Abraham Lincoln and how he made deals. But what I really call for is, this thing. I don't feel too great about people saying negative things about her, and I really can't figure out why. And I've been really stressed because she hasn't been able to turn that corner. The CNN poll last night. There's only two polls that are done that are considered scientific after these things, and CNN has one of them. That CNN poll, the results of it stated that 54% gave Hillary a favorable rating.
They thought that she won. Yeah,
she won. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They thought that she won. Well, Lorenzo, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. That's one of these things that Mrs. Clinton's supporters point to. They thought if ever there were a time for a knockout punch, it would have been last night, given the kind of 48 hours previous that Mr. Trump had. But Liz Copeland, she didn't deliver that knockout punch. She had a very strong debate. She certainly didn't do anything that screwed anything up, but it wasn't that, that final blow that's just going to, give her that 50-point lead that everybody fantasizes about.
I think that's interesting, right? My reasoning is that Hillary Clinton is a seasoned, established politician, and she has been trained in the art of finessing your statement over and over again, whittling it down to sound bites so that you can, based on focus group messaging and your campaign team, so you can speak to the American public in a very precise way. But that's not what the American public wants this cycle. They want someone to make a mistake, or they want someone to say, or maybe when they're talking. She's so precise when she communicates. I think it works to her disadvantage, and that's why she's not able to knock it out the park. She's got the policy positions that are sound and plausible, but she can't articulate them in a way with that type of forum and the time limits so that people can get it, and they feel her. They don't feel her, in my opinion.
So, Charles, what is it that she needs to do to get that knockout?
She needs to find the empathy quotient, as we like to call it.
Her EQ is kind of off, right?
Right. But the other part is that Trump's support is solid with his group. He isn't expanding, and that's a problem, okay? Because we all know if everybody who voted in those primary elections for Trump came to a general, he'd lose. He wouldn't win. And, and numbers don't lie about that. The last part of that is this. Look, these candidates are the most flawed candidates that this United States has ever had. I know when I was a kid growing up.
And what do you count among Hillary Clinton's flaws?
One.
Yeah, because many people believe exactly what you said. What are her biggest flaws?
That it's parsing of issues. In other words, I voted for the war, but now I've come to realize that it wasn't as good as it should have been. Or the whole idea, and not that that's a disqualifier as much as I think we want our politicians, and I go back to this imagery of who a president is, that we want them to almost be Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts. We want them to have honesty. We want them to not really have controversy. Come on, let's be candid. We want somebody, I think what was the average, would you want to have a beer with this person? Or a drink or whatever.
This is not even close to no drama Obama,
right,
that's for sure. Yeah.
Right, and that is missing.
But isn't that where we are as a country? And if I were to come up with a hypothesis, is it because we've got so much, the news cycle is 24/7 now, reality television shows, you have an increased involvement from a millennial population, you have an aging population that are not as involved in social media, you have social media with everyone opining on everything. I think that that's the standard that once was applied to presidential candidates is clearly not there anymore. Mm-hmm. And that for future presidential candidates, that we will either continue to go away from the standard or we will turn back once again to the very vanilla.
I got to believe in better angels. I'm sorry.
But everybody's opining, but I wonder if anybody's persuading. That's the interesting thing to me. I want to go to the phones again. Dave is on the line from Baltimore. Dave, welcome to Midday.
Yes,
thanks for your call.
And congratulations on your show. It befits your majesty, Mr. Hall. But what I wanted to say...
Well, thank you, Dave. I have no idea what you're talking about, but it sounded good. Thank you.
I think that less thoughtful people really don't like seasoned politicians, and they like emotion, they like entertainment, but... Given the danger of Trump, and we're all right in Maryland, I think we've got to be positive. We could work on our friends in PA and Virginia, and we could defeat down-ballot candidates like Zelaya, who support Trump, or Republicans running.
I'm going to correct you. She does not support Donald Trump, and she will tell you that on any occasion.
Well, Charles, she was on this show a week ago. And said she has always promised to support the Republican nominee.
Yeah, but she didn't say Trump, did she?
Well, she avoids mentioning his name, but she is voting for him and she is supporting him.
Okay.
Now, it's interesting to me, and I want to talk about this. And Dave, thank you
for your call. To interrupt you. We just need to sometimes correct the record.
Thank you for your call, because I do think she is supporting Mr. Trump. And what's interesting is that this is in stark contrast to Larry Hogan, who has endorsed her, has endorsed Kathy Zelaya. And for those of you who don't know, she's a delegate from Baltimore County and the House Minority Whip. Mr. Hogan's
And running for the United States Senate.
Yeah, and running for the United States Senate against Chris Van Hollen and Margaret Flowers, the Green candidate. The Hogan approval ratings have gone up since he's been elected. So he's now 70 plus, and he has markedly not endorsed Mr. Trump and spoken disparagingly of Trump. So it's interesting as a strategic, because Kathy Zelaya, who obviously has an uphill battle in a Democratic state running against a popular congressman, has said, well, I'm going to call balls and strikes. That's what she told me the other day. And this is a ball and strike that she doesn't want to call. She's not saying she's not separating herself from Trump the way that her mentor or her exemplar, Larry Hogan, has.
Right. So for full disclosure, I am a supporter of Kathy Zelaya. I've personally knocked on doors for Kathy Zelaya in Baltimore City and in southeast Baltimore County. I think that she's a tremendous person. I think she certainly has an uphill battle against Chris Van Hollen. The poll numbers show that she's not doing as well. It's not even a close race at this point. However, it's hard. And as a Republican, it's hard to be in a position where you're in a very blue state, 2-1 Democrats to Republicans. And you're focused on presenting your ideas, but you also have the party. So you want to present these ideas to the voters, Democrats, Independents, and Republicans. But then you have your party commitment and involvement. And she is a party leader. That's a tough position to be in, especially if you have if you desire a future within the party.
Yeah, and there are many people who think she does, in fact, desire just that, perhaps a run for governor, that kind of thing at some point. We have been talking a little bit about millennials. We have one on the line. Derek from Pasadena, welcome to Midday. Glad you called.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. What's on your mind?
I didn't think you'd get me so quickly. Yeah, let's talk about millennials for a second. I think I saw Paul, I forget who it was, something like 56% of us or feel like Donald Trump is racist, and therefore that is the lens through which we view the Republican Party. I personally think that Donald Trump has kind of destroyed Republicans, perhaps for an entire generation. And it's interesting how we talk about how Hillary Clinton parses, but all these down-ballot Republicans are talking about, well, you know, I don't support this person, but I'm still voting for him. So Kelly Ayotte got called out about this.
She's running for Senate in New Hampshire, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she said the time for moral courage is over, you know, and that's the way a lot of us feel. If you were going to bail on Trump, you should have did it after he kept talking about the Mexican wall or the Muslim ban or when Paul Ryan called him a racist. I mean,
Paul Ryan did not call him a racist. Paul Ryan did not call him a racist. He said his statements were technically textbook definition of racist. But there's no statement on the record that Paul Ryan called Donald Trump a racist.
Pretty close, though, Liz, when you say it's
the
technical definition of a racist.
I might be parsing words, but I am not a supporter of Donald Trump, but I have this visceral reaction when people say that he is, quote unquote, a racist, or where they Kanye West his campaign and say he doesn't care about black people. Like, I have nothing to, no body of work to show that he has intentionally been prejudiced against African-Americans, but conversely, nothing to show that he's done anything. He's never supported any efforts. He didn't show up up at the Urban League. He didn't show up at the NAACP conference when he was invited. So
or
let's
the NABJ but, conference.
But, yes. Or,
but so, if you go back to the Central Park 5 controversy in the 80s, you know, he's taken out full-page ads saying that these kids should be hung. You know, they were. It turns out they were framed. He never apologized for it. There is a record of him being certainly opposed to those issues that are important to the African American community.
Each one of these candidates are bringing up these various groups because they know they can't sometimes reach them, but they are talking to other people about them. You know, Donald Trump knows that he has a problem with women. So if I say, you know, I hate the term the African Americans.
Oh, yes, I hate that. Like, we're a formal group.
Or as
now,
a friend of mine said, what's the name of that? Where's that singing group? I want to see that group. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, they're talking to others. They're not talking to the people that they're talking about. They're talking about, they're trying to inform groups that fringe, that small group. And I think we all agree. If you're undecided at this point, I'm going like, where are you? You got less than 30 days to go. Where are you going to go here? And, you know, and that's that little group that they're each trying to talk to. And it's difficult to make an argument to them based on some of the both.
You have to wonder if none of the arguments heretofore have worked, what's going to work now?
Yeah, right.
But it's interesting, you know, when Trump talks about Mr. Clinton and it's all about words, he says, you know, he says the accusations against him are all about words. The accusations against President Clinton, of course, the whole other issue is what does President Clinton's behavior have to do with Hillary Clinton's, you know, capacity for the job?
Does that mean that that's her judgment because she married him? I'm trying to figure out the connection.
No one's quite explaining that connection. But if he says it's just about words, I think the amount of cynicism we have about government in general perhaps is causing these people to be, in fact, undecided at this late date. They're just used to, you know,
people aren't undecided. They just don't want to be public with their decision. Right. People who are Democrats who say, I can't really get behind Hillary, they go into that closed booth and that private vote, they're going to hit the D. See, people who say they're never Trumpers, they are appalled by him. Yeah. They're going to go in there and they're going to hit that R.
The other part is the optics. You know, we mentioned this a little bit, and I don't know if we're at that point where we can talk about it real quick about the women who showed up a half hour before this debate.
Yeah.
And I guess we got to go to break at this point.
Yeah, we didn't get to that. We're going to have to call it quits for the debate talk, but we will talk about that, you know, parading them out and having them come and sit in the audience stuff. But I appreciate both of you all coming by to celebrate Columbus Day with us. Thank you so much, and we'll see you soon. Liz Copeland is the founder of the Urban Conservative Project, Charles Robinson, a reporter for Maryland Public Television. We're going to take a quick break. Thank you for your calls. I'm sorry I didn't get to everybody. We're going to take a little break now and change topics. When we come back, a conversation about the challenges that classical music faces in including more people of color. I'm Tom Hall. Aaron Dworkin joins me in Studio A. It's midday. Stay with us.